Welcome to the program. Grab yourself a glass, pour a little bourbon. You might like it neat, you might pour a little bit over ice. I'm not sure whether, like scotch, you put maybe just a drop of water or two in there to mellow it out. We're gonna get the answer to that, though, because we have a couple experts as guests on this podcast. We're going to talk about the investment opportunity that exists in bourbon. Bourbon is booming right now. Those of you who like niche investing or like collectible investing, which oftentimes is paired with a passion. If you have a passion for bourbon or you just like to make money, this might be an opportunity for you. In fact, one of the guests on with me, I'm going to introduce in a minute, Kate Lynch and her brother, Rick Lynch. Kate Lynch authored an article that's in the February edition of Real Assets Advisor magazine about exactly this. We'll be talking about a lot of the content that's in that article, though I certainly encourage you to go read it because I'm sure there's going to be some content in there that we're not necessarily going to cover verbally right now. So Kate Lynch has had a career in investment banking, previously working on Wall Street in New York City, primarily with Deutsche Bank and Bear Stearns, focusing on bank M&As and capital raising. She continues to consult with banks while also managing a variety of real estate investments. After seeing the incredible appreciation in the price of wholesale bourbon barrels over the last 5 years, Kate and her brother, Rick Lynch, the other guest on this program, was convinced to join the team. She was encouraged and convinced to join the team at Estate Barrels, an investment vehicle to grow wealth for investors through the appreciation of aged bourbon. Rick Lynch is an entrepreneur who in 2020 embarked on a new venture when he founded Everwild Spirits, a craft bourbon distillery based in Sandusky, Ohio. Building on that success, he founded Estate Barrels, where they both operate now. That was founded in 2024. It's a $10 million private equity fund focusing on investing in the predictable. Did I say that right?
Predictable appreciation. Yeah.
Okay. Let me go back to. Building on that excessive, no excesses here, especially with alcohol. Okay. Building on that success, he founded Estate Barrels in 2024, a $10 million private equity fund focused on investing in the aged bourbon business. Kate and Rick Lynch, welcome to the program.
Thanks
for having us, Mike.
You bet. You bet. This is an interesting subject. A lot of investors like to drink. We like to drink to celebrate. We like to drink to drown our sorrows after a bad investment. And, you know, we've seen wine. We've seen various spirits that have had some booms. Kate, I'm going to start with you because you wrote an article that kind of outlines the boom in bourbon. What are the numbers saying about this? How long has this been going on? What triggered it, if there's anything identifiable, and what kind of appreciation have we been looking at?
Well, Mike, you know, I'll be straightforward with you. I worked on Wall Street and I'm not shy. So as much as I enjoy a drink as much as the next person, I'm here for one reason, and that's because I like making money. And I had actually retired and was a stay-at-home mom for a couple of years when Rick called me to talk about the bourbon industry. Rick had founded this distillery and was also retired, semi-retired, enjoying his success in managing this distillery as a passion project. But when he told me about the growth in valuation of bourbon barrels, I was completely blown away. My first thought when he explained to me the appreciation he'd seen on the barrels he already bought was, first of all, you know, it's an anomaly. It happened one time. It's not going to continue. Secondly, if it is true, then I'm sure Wall Street investors are already all over this. But because he's my brother, and he's obviously, you know, very smart and successful, I decided to help him just dig into the data a little bit and see if I agreed with him that it's something you could make money on going forward. And the more I dug into the data, the more amazed I was. There's been double-digit growth in the bourbon industry for more than 10 years. And in the high end of the bourbon industry, it's as much as, I think it's an 18% CAGR for the last 10 years and the volume of sales. The bourbon business is literally booming. And yet it's just a fraction of the size of the scotch market. Rick has talked to me a lot about, he really knows the ins and outs of it because he operates in this space every day. But the international growth potential is huge. And what's the coolest part about it is that you're actually not trying to make money from an increase in prices. Instead, you're making money from appreciation. We call it similar to when you're buying livestock. If you buy a baby animal and it matures into a grown adult animal, then it naturally appreciates in value. And so you make money even if prices stay the same. And as I dug into that, I just was blown away and told Rick, it's worth coming out of retirement to pursue it. But Rick, you can talk more about the history of it, of the bourbon successes you've had and why you got excited about getting into the space.
And before you launch into that, Rick, let me just on the front end of that, it sounds like what Kate's saying, it's a boom in the United States with growth opportunities overseas. Is the US kind of an outlier market just in terms of that we're much thirstier for bourbon than other countries? I mean, Europeans tend to drink a lot. Are they not really bourbon drinkers out there?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because people think of bourbon, right, as this historical beverage that, really was developed at the time when our country was founded, right? So a couple hundred years old. But when you look at bourbon in terms of global history, it's the youngest of the whiskeys in the marketplace, right? Scotch and Irish whiskey and Canadian whiskey and other Japanese whiskey, right, have been around much longer. And so if you're looking for an analogy for bourbon and its current market adoption level today, and where do we think that that's going to go in the future? Where can it potentially go? The best analogy is the oldest and most adopted product, which is Scotch, right? Scotch is fully distributed globally. It's got great penetration in huge populations in China, in India, South America, Middle East, Europe, et cetera. And so when you look at bourbon and its current market adoption, while it's extremely well distributed throughout the United States, it's still in its very early stages of global deployment. And so if you're trying to ascertain what is the arc and what's the where does this bubble end in terms of the boom that bourbon's been experiencing, I think when you look at the investment in the hundreds of millions of dollars that dozens of these national brands are making to expand and increase volume, it's a good sign that the international marketplace is still really largely untapped. And bourbon
So
is
this could have a very long thread then. You're saying we may just be on the front end of this. It's booming here in the US, but this could be, as it extends overseas, we could see many, many more years to come. You can't predict that, obviously, but it stands to reason.
And I think the other thing that you look at in terms of beverage as an industry category, right? Beverage is a category that has very high multiples, primarily because consumers tend to stick to a beverage for a lifetime or for a very long period of time. People have a beverage of choice, whether you're talking about water, soda, whether it's beer, wine, liquor, coffee. You have a beverage probably you can think in your head of the brands that you like, and you may have been consuming that brand for 10, 20, 30 years. So the trends that we see are generational trends. The beverage industry looks at, what is the baby boomer generation doing versus the millennials versus the Gen Xs in terms of their preferences and trends. And those are predictions for very long cycles of consumer behavior.
One of the things we've seen is I know the wine industry is keen to this. There's a lot of young people who have moved away from beer and wine. They really like their libations. Bourbon is oftentimes one of the is the hard liquor that goes in that libation. Then I've certainly noticed myself, people I know and just acquaintances or listening to people at a bar that the ordering of bourbons definitely seems to have ticked upward. So you've got young people who are in this market, maybe not from a straight drinking standpoint, but again, they love their mixed drinks. They like their fancy drinks. Bourbon is the base for a few drinks, mixed drinks that are very popular that bourbon is the base for.
Well, the old fashioned is the classic bourbon cocktail, as well as a Manhattan. There are a variety of whiskey sours, and just beyond that, a whole range of creative craft cocktails that mixologists are using bourbon as a base to innovate on. And you're certainly seeing tequila and rum as well start to become something that people are exploring, and those are certainly spirits that people are getting excited about as well. But it is, you're right, a generational thing where, people from 25 to 65 are getting interested in the craft cocktail culture, not necessarily drinking, a shot of straight whiskey, right? But enjoying and exploring bourbon in the way that maybe the baby boomers explored wine, 30, 40 years ago.
And I
And
think another relevant point here, Mike, has to do with where we are, as Rick said, in the arc of bourbon as it develops as an industry over time. So, having worked on Wall Street and worked with a lot of large private equity funds in New York City, when Rick described the kind of returns that people were getting on wholesale bourbon investments in the 30, 40, 50% annual rates of return, I just thought all of the Wall Street firms are going to go after this really hard. There's no way that those kind of returns are sustainable. But then the more I researched it, what I learned is that we have estimated that the size of the wholesale bourbon barrel market is between $300 and $500 million, which is incredibly small, right? There's certainly tons of room for growth. But when I was working with private equity firms on doing investments, many of those firms' minimum investment size was $50 or $100 million. And so for them to try to come into the bourbon space and do what we're doing with, for them, a small investment of $100 million would mean they would have to buy up a third or more of the whole market just to participate in that year, right? And I think that that's a big part of the reason why the kind of returns that are achievable now are possible for a fund like this, which is a small fund at $10 million. But at that size, we're participating at around 1 to 3% of the total market size. And you can achieve those kinds of returns if you're in a small position like that relative to the total market. But as we see the industry grow, there'll be the ability to deploy more dollars in bigger dollar amounts. And presumably, over some time frame, right? Maybe it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, when the market is big enough, those large players will come in and chase those returns, and you'll see those returns normalize. But we see at least we're speculating here, but we see at least a 5 to 10 year duration in front of us where we think we can get really strong returns. And the fund that we've designed only has a 2 year life cycle, so that purposely we allow ourselves the ability to get out quickly. And then next year we'll reinvest for another 2 year cycle and continue doing that as long as it stays this strong.
In Kate Lynch's article in the magazine, if you're sitting back and thinking, how do I get in on this? Well, that article, the whole point of the article was to talk about the four different ways that a person can invest in bourbon. I'm just going to tick them off here quick, and then I'll have Kate elaborate. You can invest in a private investment vehicle. You can invest in a bourbon distillery. You can invest in publicly traded industry players, or you can invest through a web-based bourbon buyer. And I just wanted to foreshadow those four different ways to invest. And I believe, Kate, you identified one that you thought was the best way to invest. Which of those would you say is the best way to invest, or the one likely to get the best returns?
Well, obviously, since Rick and I are working on launching a bourbon investment fund, that's the path that I see as the most likely to create those kind of returns. But I would say, you may say that
So a
I'm
private investment
biased.
vehicle, a private investment. It doesn't have to be your vehicle, but you're saying a private investment vehicle of some kind.
Exactly. But I certainly, at this point, I'm working on that path. But I'm doing it because I see this as the way to make money in the space. So Rick actually, when he founded his distillery and was buying barrels of bourbon, he saw that the valuations on those barrels was going up rapidly. Rick, do you want to talk about how you went through that process to come to the conclusion that this is the best way to make money rather than working with another vehicle?
Sure. So, most new distilleries, and there's about 150 to 200 distilleries that are opening every year for the last 10 years in the United States. Not necessarily all bourbon, but a lot of them are bourbon. Most new distilleries will start by buying what's called contract bourbon. They'll pay another distillery, a large facility, to produce the product for them, their recipe, and start aging that product so that while the new distillery is building out and getting ready to open up, they've got something that's aging and ready to bottle at the time that they open up. And that's what we did. So we are currently bottling products that we had contract distilled. And so we purchased those products as what they call new make back in 2019, 2020. And at that time, the cost of a barrel was around $600 with the storage and insurance fees that we had to carry over that 4 year period. You're probably adding another $200 in cost to that barrel. So let's say all in about $800 a barrel. As we started to bottle product, I'm looking at always at what the barrel price market is and potentially buying more barrels. And all along the way, I'm stunned to see that the value of these barrels is climbing 30, 40, 50% year over year. So today, those $800 barrels are selling between $3,200 and $3,500 a barrel.
Wow.
Just an astounding return. Now, the run-up over the last 4 years was a little bit higher than normal because of COVID and some of the supply chain issues. I don't think that's a natural rate of gain for barrel long term. We think it's more in the 20 to 30% gain range year over year. But that's still phenomenal, certainly when you compare that to equities or to bonds or to other alternative investments.
How many bottles come out of a barrel?
About 240 typically.
Okay. And the best bourbon is distilled where? I mean, I think of Tennessee and Kentucky, but is there any? I mean, if you're distilling it, it can be done anywhere, right? It doesn't necessarily have to do with geography. Is that right or not?
To some degree, yes. I mean, certainly almost, I think 95% of all bourbon is made in Kentucky, but by law, it can be made in any of the 50 US states. And there are distilleries literally in all 50 states, many, many distilleries. There's over, I think, 2,700 currently. But the best bourbon, I think by global perception, right, people believe comes from Kentucky. From an investment standpoint, we would only see what we would consider to be blue chip Kentucky bourbon because we feel that that's going to have the greatest market value at the time of sale. But there are some phenomenal award-winning bourbons, including our own, that aren't made in Kentucky. It's just consumer, I think, preference will tend to gravitate towards a Kentucky-made product.
So, Kate, tell us more about how we can make money.
Well, so a lot of this does come down to the process that Rick went through. As you mentioned earlier, the Rick had helped found a fintech company, two fintech companies actually, that sold to Visa. So he was in a position where he had received a large chunk of money that he put into the stock market, and then also created a distillery on the side as a passion project. And as he saw the increase in value in the bourbon barrels, far outpacing the returns he was getting from his investment portfolio that was managed by a major money management bank, he started looking for other ways to invest. And he explained to me that he had looked at a number of other options and was just shocked at the pricing that he saw from them. Rick, do you want to talk about that?
So really, I was not planning to start a private equity fund myself. I was looking to invest through another fund that was already established. And as I explored what those funds were offering in terms of their terms and duration and costs, being a distiller myself, I recognized that they were adding quite a bit of markup to the costs. And maybe because consumers aren't aware what the fair market price per barrel is. Getting away with charging quite a bit more than they should be for good investors. What I'm really trying to do is structure my fund to give investors a low entry point and the ability to get out of that investment in 2 years, which we feel like is a really attractive duration period, and not marking up the barrel $1,000 or $1,200 at the front side, right? And making all my money at the front. So we've structured it where I earn. The fund earns its profits on the yield, and it's not something where it's front loaded and the investors kind of get taken advantage of. Bourbon is not something that you can look at the market price on the stock market on the Nasdaq or the Dow, right? And it's kind of a hidden thing unless you're within the industry. And so I think a lot of retail investors are potentially getting taken advantage of because they don't know what the fair market value is. So part of what we try to do with conversations like this is educate the marketplace, so that they can make an informed investment.
Are most investors bourbon drinkers, or is it really just, look, I'm an investor, I want to make money, and I don't even touch the stuff? You have any way of knowing that?
I would say about half and half. I have some investors that said, "Hey, geez, I've spent a lot of money on alcohol. It'd be really nice to make some money back from alcohol," which I took. Quite a kick out of. But I think there's certainly some institutional investors too that are coming at this more like from Kate's perspective that the metrics just are pretty compelling, and they may not even be in a person that drinks alcohol at all at this time, but they can understand the economics of it.
Yes, the thing about this investment is really easy to understand. I mean, it's kind of like buying a home. A home is your kind of a basic real estate investment, but everybody understands, hey, people like to drink, and the value of these things do go up over time. Kate, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to throw out there. So, as I have conversations with potential investors, Probably at least half of the people that I introduce the concept to will say immediately, "Oh, I love bourbon," right? And so that starts the conversation going. And as Rick said, there's no doubt in my mind that bourbon is the new thing. It's the hot drink. It's what people want to talk about. There are bourbon clubs all over the place. But for people who are thinking about that boom in the bourbon space and saying to themselves, "How can I invest in it?" Certainly, investing in a local distillery can be an interesting play. The challenge with that is your returns are tied solely to the performance of that one distillery. And the next obvious way to invest for most people, if you just Google invest in bourbon, is one of these web-based groups that is connecting bourbon investors with the kind of wholesale barrels that we're acquiring. The problem is, as Rick said, the buyer in those cases have no idea what the fair market value is of the barrel. And I was shocked that it's even legal for these groups to charge the kind of prices they charge once I was looking at the numbers that Rick shared with me. So because Rick is active in buying and selling the wholesale barrels of bourbon, he has constant access to pricing sheets for every kind of bourbon that's out there. And I called him one day and I said, "Hey, I just got some information from one of these web-based groups. I signed up for their website just to get the information from them." And I said, "They're charging $2,400 for this barrel that you told me is priced at $1,250. Can that be right?" And he said, "Yeah, they're literally charging almost double the price for the barrel to an investor. And then they're still charging 20 or 30% of the profit on the exit." So I think that the more we can do conversations like this to talk about what it means to buy wholesale bourbon and how you can find out with a partner who is aligned with your interests, the better the space will be, and we can get rid of some of those shadier groups that are really taking advantage of a lack of knowledge on the part of the investors.
Now, you did mention also in the article, invest in publicly traded industry players. Name a couple of the big industry players that people could invest in.
Yeah, so I think it's really hard to find a pure bourbon play. Gosh, I have to even look at their ticker symbol. So Diageo trades under the symbol DEO. Constellation Brands, which owns Corona, Robert Mondavi Wines, Svedka Vodka, and some others, is under STZ. As we talked about earlier, I spent more than 20 years on Wall Street. My specialty on Wall Street was investing in banks. And the banks that I helped with doing M&A and capital raises, I knew those companies inside and out at a level that your average investor could never understand. I knew which management teams were good. I knew what their growth strategies were. I knew which CFOs had a drinking problem, right? And so the level of knowledge that the Wall Street experts have about these firms, about the publicly traded companies, is so incredible compared to your average investor that once I got out of the Wall Street business, I would never invest directly in a publicly traded company because I just know that I don't have the amount of knowledge that the insiders have. And I truly believe that the market is efficient. There absolutely are inefficiencies at times here and there. But without going through and reading the 10-Ks and 10-Qs and meeting with management and talking to them about their strategy, I think personally, investing in any publicly traded company is unlikely to capture excess returns relative to the overall market performance. So, to the extent that your audience here is a sophisticated investor and is looking for opportunities to get outsized returns, I think that there is a possibility of doing that with an individual distillery, in particular, one that you do have the opportunity to get to know well. But you are making a bet on just that one distillery. And so I think that, as you said, the bourbon investment thesis is relatively straightforward, something that your average investor can understand. The nuance to it that I think is really important, though, is that we are not buying retail bourbon bottles. It is the wholesale barrels of bourbon. And that's a part of the market that I think your average individual has no idea even exists in the marketplace. And as Rick, if you want to talk a little bit about what that marketplace is like and how the barrels are bought and sold and stored and that.
Well, yeah, I mean, really, there was no market 15 years ago, right? There was only about 200 distilleries in the country back in 2012, and all of those distilleries made the product that they needed for themselves, and there wasn't buying and selling of barrels going on. because laws changed around 2012 that made craft distillery possible in a similar way to the way laws changed and made craft brewing possible maybe 15, 20 years earlier. We saw this industry start to develop. And again, we've gone from 200 distilleries to about 2,700 distilleries in the last 12 years. So a marketplace has bloomed. And in that marketplace now, there are small little shops and brands that have taken off and become top 10 national sellers. When growth occurs, as we know, bourbon needs to age. It's not something we can make overnight. It needs 4 years of age. So if you have a new distillery brand, a new bourbon product on the shelf, and it starts to take off, and you want national distribution, and you only made 200 barrels, you got to go out and get product from the marketplace to help you cover the demand of your exploding brand. And that's where a lot of this buying and selling happens. So we think there's about 30,000 barrels bought and sold each month. And again, this 15 years ago, there were zero. So it's a new marketplace. And as to Kate's point, wasn't probably one that most consumers were even aware of was occurring. It's really something that's just developed very recently. I think the other key point to make about bourbon is we were talking earlier about equities. As Kate mentioned, I had an exit from a company I sold, and much of my resources from that sale I had invested in the stock market, and it's been a very volatile last few years with COVID and everything else that's occurred. And I got pretty frustrated with my investment in equities. And at the same time, we saw bonds not perform as they were supposed to perform. And that really put me on a journey to looking at other investments. My first thought was not bourbon. I looked at real estate. I looked at a number of other alternative investments, private equity funds, et cetera. But what really stood out for me for bourbon is, A, it's decoupled from the markets. It doesn't trend with the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ. It's recession resistant. So if you look back at the COVID recession or you go back to 2008, this category does better in hard times. It actually grew 29% during the COVID recession.
Not
Another really
surprising, right? A lot of alone time sitting there, biding your time, sipping on a bourbon. Go ahead. Go ahead, Brett.
intriguing aspect of it is that this is a product that's insured. So I can't buy stock in Google and get an insurance policy that'll protect me and guarantee that I'll never lose money on that investment. In the case of bourbon, when we purchase those barrels, we insure those barrels, and they're insured for the mark-to-market value. So as those bourbon barrels age and gain value, if 2 years from now, the warehouse where we store our barrels is destroyed by a fire or a tornado or what have you, the insurance policy will pay us for the full market value of those barrels. So I don't have the risk that I might have in other types of investments that can't be insured. It's also, a product that has low volatility. It as Kate mentioned earlier, like livestock, right? It's going to gain value. Whether it gains 20% year over year or whether it's going to gain 30 or 40% year over year, we'll see, how that does. But it's not a product that loses value as it ages. It gains value just intrinsically. So those are all really intriguing aspects about this category that it's hard to find an analogy for that in many other investments.
So, if you're a private equity fund, I mean, private equity funds like yours and others, how does that money get invested? Is it you find high quality distilleries, maybe bourbon specific, or you're actually buying the barrels? Is that right? You're investing, but who's producing those barrels? I mean, how
Yes.
does the investment take place?
So the fund manager ideally has good relationships at distilleries, in Kentucky or elsewhere, right? And they're negotiating on behalf of the members of that fund to get the best possible product at the lowest possible price. And then you're essentially purchasing those barrels as newly made product. They're typically going to age. The product's going to age in Kentucky or wherever you have it made. So you don't need to introduce transport risk. And the fund is going to be the one that's responsible for negotiating the sale of those barrels at the time that they mature. Different funds have different trajectories. So our particular fund is a 2-year trajectory. We think there's really strong reasons why 2 years make sense, but there are funds out there that are for 4 years or 8 years, and certainly for funds and other types of spirits as well. There's Scotch whiskey funds, there's Irish whiskey funds, there's Japanese whiskey funds. The nice thing about the bourbon aging process is it's relatively short compared to Scotch or Japanese whiskey or others. So your time horizon is pretty compressed. And we really like that short duration because we think it keeps us nimble enough that if the market does change, we don't have a lot of long-term exposure.
Hey, I'm going to give you six words from the article you wrote and ask you to comment on them. Pappy Van Winkle cult-like status.
I'll let Rick take that one.
Is that the standard, Rick? Is Pappy Van Winkle the kind of ultimate or the distillery that everybody's gunning for?
So Pappy Van Winkle is a fantastic bourbon. I don't know that I'll ever pay $10,000 for a bottle of it, but it's certainly one of the best bourbons out there. And because there's such a limited supply, it has taken off and become really kind of an iconic symbol for the whole industry. I don't think it's a great investment to chase retail bottles to buy and expect the kind of gains that we see on the wholesale side. But there's certainly people that like to chase and collect those unique and rare retail bottles. And I think at times you can get lucky and you can get a really nice return on it. It's absolutely a fantastic bourbon. It's kind of a standard bearer for the industry. And it's a bellwether for, the popularity of the category.
So you drink it if you're at a party and it was being served and you appreciate it, but you don't want to put any money into that one. You see better opportunities for run-ups.
I think that as Kate had mentioned earlier, the wholesale approach takes you out of the risk of a particular brand, right? We're purchasing the product at wholesale, and we ultimately don't know what bottle that's going to end up in. It could end up in an RTD, a ready-to-drink cocktail. It could end up in a Kentucky bourbon brand. It could end up in a brand that's a Japanese whiskey overseas. What we know is that there's a lot of demand for bourbon as a commodity, and that we expect that demand to last a long time. I don't want to get kind of stuck picking which horse is going to win. I'd rather, be buying the product that the industry can buy collectively.
Yeah,
And I
and
would say,
that's the risk in going to a particular distillery. It might not be successful. That's what you both were saying, I think, that you don't want to go to an individual distillery because you want a portfolio approach to it.
yeah, and I think there's a fundamental difference between buying bottled bourbon and buying a wholesale barrel of bourbon. So, certainly people have made money investing in bottles of bourbon, but people have also made money in Vegas, right? Just because you did doesn't mean that that it
Yeah, a
makes
lot of
sense as
people
an
lie
investment.
about making money in Vegas, right?
True. And similarly on the bourbon bottle front, you have people who will buy, 100 different bottles and they'll make money on one of them and not mention the other 99 that are still sitting in their living room. But I think that the fundamental difference is that if you buy a bottle of rare bourbon, you're betting, really betting, that at some point somebody else will want to pay more for it if you're buying it as an investment. Whereas when you buy a wholesale barrel of new make bourbon, you are simply waiting for it to transform into aged bourbon. And the price of aged bourbon is different than the price of new make bourbon in the same way that the price of a 500-pound hog is different than the price of a 20-pound piglet, right? It's just a different animal. And so I think that and as Rick mentioned, there are funds out there that are buying 2-year, 4-year barrel aged barrels of bourbon and expecting to make money from the appreciation of them over time. And it's true that the longer the bourbon ages in a barrel, the more intrinsically valuable it becomes. But the fundamental transformation between a new make product, which is a clear liquid that tastes and smells awful, into a 2 or 4 year aged bourbon that has the delicious flavor and smell and taste, it's just a different animal completely. And so that's why we like that part of the life cycle of bourbon, and we think that fundamental transformation. I mean, you can never guarantee that anything will make money, but it seems like the 2 year aged barrel will always be more valuable than an unaged barrel. And right now, the relative price difference is the 2 year barrel today is priced at approximately 2 times the price of a new make barrel, right? So that implies if prices don't move at all, you double your money in 2 years. Even if the price of the 2 year were to drop by 25%, you'd still make a 20% annual rate of return over the next 2 years. I have never in my life seen an investment where the price of the product can drop by 25% and I make a 20% annual rate of return. And I think that probably the thing that really I learned most fundamentally working on Wall Street is that the most successful investors there are buying things at a price that is below what they know the value to be. And that's a hard thing to do, right? In some cases, you're getting a great deal on a commercial real estate building because the buyer is or the seller is distressed, or in other cases, you're buying a whole company in the case of private equity firms from a CEO who wants to retire. And so the private equity fund is able to buy it at a price below what they know that it's worth in the market. And in this case, the difference between the appreciated price at 2 years and the new make price, the only difference is time. We don't have to change operations. We don't have to bring in new management. We don't have to increase the rent rolls. We just wait. We never touch the product. And I love it. I mean, I literally have never seen an investment like it, and I'm trying to put as much of my own net worth into it as I can.
So eventually, all hot commodities, all hot real assets, cool.
Absolutely.
What do you look at? What's going to be your indicators there? Because obviously, you've already made the case that people can turn around in a matter of just a couple of years and make some money on this, or the timeline doesn't have to be 7 to 10 years like a lot
Right.
of VC investments or private equity investments. But obviously, you want to know when it's starting to run, the momentum is falling off.
And I think
What are
that,
your indicators?
I think that the advantage that we have relative to the couple other groups out there that are doing something similar to what we're doing is that Rick also owns a distillery. And he's not, managing it day to day, but he's sole owner of it, and sees every single day what's going on in that distillery. He's seeing what's going on with his own sales, and he also is getting information from the brokers and the distilleries that he interacts with about where prices are, what volume is. He constantly is telling me, this distiller or this bottler has a 20% shortfall relative to what they want to bottle next year. He just has that access to information that me as an investment banker, I don't have, and I'm not going to go start a distillery to try to get it. It's certainly something that somebody else could build if they wanted to spend the next 5 years studying the bourbon industry and creating their own distillery. But we're starting this fund with this in-depth knowledge and expertise that Rick has developed over the last 5 years. And I think that's invaluable as a fund manager because he is seeing those trends live. He's hearing, he every day it seems like is telling me some new piece of information that he heard from one guy or another. At this point, it's all looking to the positive, and I love getting those messages from him saying, hey, here, listen to this, what I heard here and there. But at some point, the tide will turn. And I hope we get a good 10-year run out of this. But if it's 3 years, then we stop in 3 years. I mean, we're investing our own money as heavily as we can in the fund, and we're not going to put our own money into something if it's not going to make these returns.
Right. What's the proper way to drink bourbon, Rick? Is it neat? As in just you drink it without any ice or anything mixed into it? Or is I mean I've always been told that if you truly appreciate whiskey or bourbon or scotch, you drink it neat. Is that the truth or not?
Well, there's no wrong answer here. I think the most important thing is you drink it the way you like it. Certainly there are folks that drink it neat. I think
How do you drink it?
I typically will drink it with one ice cube. What I really enjoy is as that ice slowly melts, it's gonna, dilute it a little bit. And as it dilutes, it's gonna open up the bourbon and expose, more flavors, different kind of flavor profiles throughout the course of sipping it. So that's my
No.
preference.
Gotcha. Let me run this past you. I don't like scotch. I was telling this guy one time, he was a big scotch drinker. I said, it tastes like poison to me. And then he demonstrated putting a drop of water. He says, go ahead and sip it. Okay, you don't like that flavor. Put a drop of water in it. And one single drop of water, and it really changed the character of it a lot, mellowed
Yes.
it out. And he said, if that still doesn't quite do it, let's put another drop of water in. I tasted it again, and it really changed the character of it a lot. Is that the case with bourbon, or does it not work the same way?
Yes. So bourbon, scotch are both whiskeys, and that really applies to all whiskeys. People will say water is a friend to whiskey. So unlike wine or beer, where you typically don't want to water it down, then the case is not the same for whiskey. Whiskey has actually benefits from oxygenation, and it benefits from a little bit of water. So those are both good things.
Interesting.
Mike, are you a cigar smoker?
I'm not. My brother is, though. Tell me what you to tell me and the listeners, because I'll pass along to my brother. He might want a bourbon with his next cigar.
Well, when I was working on Wall Street, it was pretty popular after closing a deal for the guys to go out for cigars. And as I was working my way up the ladder, I didn't like being left out on those outings, and so I learned how to smoke cigars. So the first time I went out with the guys to smoke cigars, I felt like my mouth was an ashtray. And I had a glass of bourbon, and it tasted like water. It was like wine and cheese. Like, it's not harsh at all. It completely cleanses the nasty flavor. So I think that's why a lot of people are drinking whiskey when they're smoking a cigar.
Yeah, that and cognac, right? I think cognac's another popular one. My brother usually drinks a bottle of red wine with it, but this is a good alternative to the red wine, and maybe won't give him a headache. Although I've heard certainly heard of people drinking whiskey getting headaches. I've had them myself. So
Yeah, anything
this
you
is
drink too much, it'll get you there.
exactly. So parting advice for investors, Kate. And I just want to remind our listeners again that the article is on the Real Assets Advisor website that Kate wrote that gets into this in more detail. And just so that you can go to the search bar and look it up, either get the magazine or you can go to the web and in the search bar, just put in liquid assets, four ways to invest in the bourbon boom, and it will take you there. Parting advice, Kate?
Yeah, I think anybody who's listening to your show is probably already a sophisticated investor. And so, my sole piece of advice would be if you want to get into this space, make sure that you are investing alongside with whoever is leading the investment, because then you know that your interests will be aligned with theirs. And, when you have a situation where their money makes profit at the same level of yours, then they're going to make the right decisions with your money.
Yeah, there you go. And as I think you were saying, Rick, it's non-correlated, it's stable, it did well during recessionary times or the COVID pandemic and so on. And that's really investors looking to diversify their portfolios so that not only do they get returns, but they help stabilize them.
Well, particularly at this time where there's a lot of concern about inflation, it's an inflation hedge as well. So the key inputs and costs for bourbon are the white American oak barrel. That's about 25% of the cost. You've got the grain cost, the labor, which of course labor costs we know have been going up pretty steadily, and the petroleum for shipping and whatnot. So as we hope inflation does not go up, at the same time, if it does increase, it's going to drive the exit price of these barrels up as inflation rises. And so that's one of the things that has really been a key factor in the raise that we've seen over the last 3 to 4 years. And inflation is a sticky thing. It's something that historically has not been easily solved. I certainly hope it does get solved, but I like how bourbon protects us if it doesn't.
My guests have been Kate Lynch and her brother, Rick Lynch. Rick and Kate, thank you so much for taking the time and giving us some insight into this opportunity.
Thank you as well.
It was our pleasure. Thanks for having us.